Thanks for the invitation. I want to make sure everybody feels welcome to ask questions. I'll shut down the questions if I don't think I have time to answer them. But when I used to work in Toronto, I spent lots of time in the seats, quite lost. It's not my intention to lose anybody tonight, so especially at this hour of the night, it's easy to fall asleep. Okay, so I'm a finance guy, so there's some technical motivation to the paper, and technically it's a mess, but there's lots of kind of interesting economic questions that I think we're interested in. So the paper itself is going to develop a no-arbitrage model for term or swap rates, term structures, the yield curves in the 10 major currencies in the world. So we're going to work with the G10 countries. And this kind of joint model of how all of the yield curves in the world evolve together allows us to look at lots of interesting questions. So one is, does information in kind of global swap markets help us to better predict how each country's individual yield curve is going to change, right? So the question we're asking is, if we're sitting here in Canada and we want to get a guess at what the five-year yield is going to look like 1 month from now, do all I need to do is look at the state of the Canadian yield curve, or does it help me to also look at the state of the U.S. yield curve, the yen yield curve, Australia's yield curve, et cetera? We can look at how many price risk factors are there across global fixed income markets. Does each country kind of have their own price risk factors? There are two price risk factors, three price risk factors in each country. We're going to show lots of, I think, empirical evidence that if you actually want to take any of these models out of sample, there's pretty good evidence that there's actually only one good risk factor across all 10 of these countries. And then finally, once you've got a full kind of specified dynamic model and you've estimated all the parameters, you can go back and say, what's the kind of risk-reward trade-off that investors in this market face, right? So by the investors in this market, I mean you're a fixed income investor. You're allowed to invest in any maturity bond in any of the G10, basically the most liquid currencies in the world. You're not restricted to just investing in Canadian bonds or just investing in U.S. bonds. You can take a kind of global outlook on things. All right, so outline is there's not a whole lot of us that do work on term structure models, so I'm going to give you kind of a brief review of how single currency models work. We'll go through how well they kind of capture the cross-section of prices. By cross-section, I mean how well does the model do at matching what the yield curve looks like today, not how well does it do at predicting how yields are going to change from day to day. That's going to come in kind of handy later on when we go to a multi-currency setting, in that all of the cross-sectional fits are basically going to stay the same when we go to a multi-currency setting, so it's not completely wasted time. I'll briefly review pricing theory with multiple currencies. The kind of math people in the audience will find it trivial. It's kind of tripped up economists for far too long, so there's some simple kind of mathematical results that'll clear things up. And then we'll go through the real trick, I think, when you develop a multi-currency model is you have to think about risk premium. Okay, so you have to think about, are you going to let there be one priced risk factor in each country? Are you going to let there be one price risk factor across all countries, or two or three or four? You need to do something to kind of narrow down the parameter space and to attach some kind of economics to what you're doing. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then finally, we'll just look at plots and tables and pictures, and you can try to keep your eyes open and stuff like that. All right. So we're basically working with the fundamental theorem of asset pricing, which is kind of taught in your first mathematical finance class. It says if there's no arbitrage opportunities in the market, then there's a pricing kernel, a strictly positive pricing kernel M, or a risk-neutral measure Q, such that the price of any payoff in the future is just the risk-neutral expected discounted payoff today, or in terms of pricing kernels, it's just the expectation of our pricing kernel multiplied by that price. Right? In term structure models, we take a kind of reduced form approach to this. Right? So I'm going to be asking the question, what M seems to be most consistent with both the cross-section of yield curves that we see in the G10 countries and the dynamics of those yield curves, right? How are they kind of changing through time? Finance guys tend to work more with the pricing kernel notation. Math guys tend to work more with the risk-neutral notation. They're identical, just as a quick reminder on your stochastic calculus. So if you just define your risk-free rate as basically the negative expected drift on your pricing kernel, and Z as the exponential of that. Then ZMT is a local martingale, right? You can just kind of walk through that. Actually, I should say, too, if you're interested, I'm going to go through some of the slides quickly. There's far too many slides for a 45-minute talk, but if you're interested in some of the details, I left up where the slides are on my website. So ZMT is a local martingale. You put in some conditions to make it a full martingale, and then you can define a risk-neutral pricing measure by ZMT, right? And that risk-neutral pricing measure has the properties that the expectation of any variable under that risk-neutral pricing measure is just this, and the drift of any variable under that risk-neutral pricing measure is just its actual drift plus how that variable co-varies with the log of the pricing kernel. All right, so you can think of log of your pricing kernel is basically your kind of change of measure term. All right, so single currency term structure models, basically we're not working with any payoffs, right? The payoffs on interest rate or swaps are always one, right? I'm going to be working with zero coupon yields. So these things aren't going to be varying through time. We're going to focus all of our efforts basically on modeling what that pricing kernel looks like. Okay, so we have to model the drift of that pricing kernel, which we'll typically refer to as the short interest rate. All right, and an affine model, affine models are popular because you can basically solve everything in closed form or up to an ODE, which is pretty quick. So the drift of the pricing kernel is going to be affine in our state vector. The quadratic variation of that state vector is going to be affine in the states. I'm going to be working mostly with a Gaussian model, so you can think of this term as basically being zero. So we're not working with any stochastic volatility to begin with. It's hard enough without it. And then the risk-neutral drift of the state vector is affine in the states. Okay, so far all we've done is specify the kind of risk-neutral dynamics of everything. So we can get prices, right? I can tell you what the yield curve looks like at any point in time given my state vector. But we don't have any predictions for how that yield curve is going to change, right? We don't have everything returns the risk-free rate under the risk-neutral measure, so there's no excess returns for everybody, but we know that's not reality. Okay, so far we're just doing everything under the risk-neutral measure. If you're a math guy, you don't typically see pricing kernels written down. You typically just see the kind of reduced form math model, which is that the short rate is an affine function of the state vector. That state vector has affine drift and affine diffusion terms under the risk-neutral measure. Zero-coupon bond prices are affine. Under those assumptions on the previous page, we can compute the weights. So they're exponential affine in the state vector. We can compute those weights. For the general term, we know them up to the solution of some ODEs, which are pretty simple to solve quickly. We're going to be working in a Gaussian case, so we know these solutions in closed form. Now, I was a Waterloo student, so I remember when I was a master's student, I thought, why does anybody ever care whether or not they have closed form solutions? I can do Monte Carlo analysis and simulate 10,000 or 100,000 paths for any parameters and calculate the prices in 2 or 3 seconds. What's the problem with 2 or 3 seconds? And then I went to graduate school and learned that somebody has to actually estimate the parameters. And for estimation, you're basically doing billions and billions of guesses at what the parameter should be. If every time you make a guess at what the parameter should be, it costs you 2 seconds to actually compute prices, you spend a lot of time kind of staring at your computer screen. So now I understand a little better why you need to have closed form or ODEs that you can solve in fractions of a second rather than Monte Carlo that you can solve in 2 or 3 seconds. Sorry? Nobody ever estimates anything. We just calibrate, or somebody magically gives you the parameters. All right. So what are the factors? Basically, all of this, once you take a, I don't even know if you need to take a graduate course, but once you realize you can solve all this thing, you realize that the whole thing is finding out what the actual factors are. In general, this pricing kernel is the projection of any pricing kernel, so there's lots of available pricing kernels out there. We're going to be working with the minimum variance pricing kernel, which is the unique projection of any pricing kernel. I'm using U prime because the economists like to think of the pricing kernel as being your marginal utility. So you project that down onto the space of assets that you're trying to price. What does that imply? It implies that your pricing kernel's got to be a function of those prices. In this case, I'm using Y for yields because there's a one-to-one mapping between yields and prices. So your pricing kernel is a function of the yields, which basically means that your state vector is a function of your yields.
Sorry, the yields are a function of maturity.
Yes.
Sorry, it's infinite.
Yes. Curve. Yes. I mean, we're not going to be working with infinity. We're going to be working with 10 points on the curve. But yes, so you have a big state vector here, right? What that means is your state vector X has got to be a function of those yields. Now, you're in an affine model, so it's got to be a linear function of those yields. So we're just going to make life simple and say our state vector is just the first two or three principal components of yields. All right. Typically, two or three PCs explain about 90% of the variation in yields. If you go to four, I think it's a reasonable argument that you're just starting to pick up noise. If you go to two, you're going to miss some spots on the curve. So later on, we're going to move into estimation. We have 10 currencies. For eight of those currencies, we're going to use three-factor models. For two of the currencies, we don't have a lot of swap data early in our sample period, so we're just going to go to a two-factor model, right? Use three factors to describe three prices. You don't really have a model, right? They're always going to match exactly. So you need less factors than your prices to actually say that you've got a model.
To clarify, are you saying that whatever the utility is there for the marginal utilities, the projection is going to be the same, or are you saying that for different utilities, it's still projecting against?
No, for any, what I'm saying is for any marginal utility or any pricing kernel you have that prices those assets, right, there could be lots of them.
Right.
I could take one and I could add some independent random noise to it, and it's still going to price the same set of assets. The projection down or the minimum variance one is going to be unique. Okay, so even in incomplete markets, there's still a unique minimum variance pricing kernel. All right, so it looks like we have lots of parameters floating around, right? Rho naught, let's say that X is a three-dimensional vector. Rho naught is one-dimensional. Rho one is three-dimensional. Forget about these guys for a sec. H0 has 3 by 2 by 1, so it has 6 parameters. Theta has 3 parameters. Kappa has 3 by 3 parameters. So there's already kind of lots of parameters floating around in your model. And you need to go out and estimate them. But if you want to impose no arbitrage, you get to eliminate lots of these. So the factors themselves are linear combinations of the yields, but the yields are going to be affine functions of your state vector, right, where those affine functions depend on the parameters in your model. Okay, so if you plug Y back into here, you better get X back out, or there's some type of internal inconsistency in your model that you could call arbitrage or whatever you want. You could just say that 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 2. So that means that we get three restrictions here. All right, this vector has to be 0, and this matrix has to be the identity. So we started out with 16 parameters. We got down to 12 restrictions, so now we're down to 4 parameters. I think I probably left out the top here, which is the covariance parameters. So this H naught is basically what this is, are really easy to estimate. Right. If you give me a kind of time series, estimating what the volatility of that time series was when it's not time varying is a click of the button. Okay, so the part I want you to take out of this is pricing parameters are really easy to estimate. Right? Covariance matrices are really easy to estimate. You have 4 parameters here. The 4 parameters have to describe the whole yield curve at each point in time. So think of 10 years, you want to describe weekly data. You have 10 points on the yield curve. Right, so you have 10 points, 50 observations every year, so now you're at 500. Take that for 10 years, you have 5,000 observations. You only need to estimate 4 parameters, essentially. Okay, you can identify these things pretty easily. Not that hard. It takes about 3 or 4 seconds on a laptop. All right, so I'll give you an idea of how well these models tend to do at capturing the cross-section of yields. Right, remember the exercise is, you tell me these linear combination of yields at any point in time. So you can think of these as basically the level, slope, and curvature of the yield curve. So you tell me what the level, slope, and curvature of the yield curve is, and an affine model will spit out the weights for the rest of the yield curve, essentially. Right? So you tell me average level, what the slope looks like, and what the kind of curvature of the... Does that look like a curvature, then? What the curvature of the yield curve looks like, and I'll tell you, based on my model, what the rest of the curve looks like. All right, so we're doing 10 currencies. Every currency is a three-factor model except for New Zealand and Norway. where we're missing some data early on in the sample, so we used a two-factor model there. In sample, we're estimating the parameters from 93 until the end of 2001, and then we want to check and make sure that the model is just not overfitting in sample, so we want to see how well it's doing out of sample, so we'll take that from the beginning of 2002 till the March of 2009. All right, we got seven yields on each curve, so 3 months, 6 months, 2 years, 3, 5, 7, and 10. These dates correspond to when we actually have swaps for those things, right? And we're bootstrapping a yield curve out from the swap rates. Okay. So what I'm going to show you is lots of plots that basically measure what the root mean squared error is. So what I mean is, if I'm sitting here in the first week of 1993 and I observe that the five-year U.S. yield is 7.5%, if my model says that it's 7.55%, right, then there would be a 5 basis point yield. I'm going to sum those up for all of the observations that I have. Each one I'm going to square and then take the average of it and then the square root. In general, it's about 5 basis points, right? So on average, you're kind of missing any given yield by about 5 basis points for most of these models. When you think that kind of average interest rates are in the neighborhood of kind of 5 to 7% from 93 till now, 5 basis points is pretty good, right? You want to take out that they do a reasonably good job of disguising the cross-section. It's not horribly surprising. Level, slope, and curvature are kind of general. If you think more specifically, if somebody told you what the 3-month U.S. yield was, the 2-year U.S. yield, and the 10-year U.S. yield, if you draw basically any line between those 3 points, you're not going to be too far off. Right? I mean, the 5-year yield generally has to be somewhere between 2 and 10. There's only so many ways you can draw a line through them. Affine models are one, but basically any 3-factor model does reasonably well at the cross-section. All right? It doesn't even have to be a finance model. You could just spline the curve if you want. Okay, so blue lines are in sample, red lines are out of sample. This is the U.S., so these are root mean squared errors. All of these models tend to do poorly at the short end of the curve. We're really describing something with a diffusion process that should be described by a jump process, right? The Fed keeps interest rates at 1%, and they don't go 1 and a little bit, you know. They go 1, 1.25, 1.5, 1.25, or I guess lately 0.25, 0.25, 0.25, right? But it's a jump process. So you're going to be missing it when you try to approximate it with a Gaussian distribution. But in general, you can see, here's your kind of 5 basis point line. Even out of sample, the model does really well. Pounds the same. Here's your kind of 5 basis point line. You get a pretty good fit across the spectrum. Japan, all right. Australia does pretty well. Australia is interesting in that it tends to be better out of sample for a lot of these things than it did in sample. Australia, New Zealand, some of the kind of more fringe currencies, the swap markets weren't super developed in 93 when we started estimating the models. So you literally look at the data and you kind of have a pretty good feeling that there's problems with it. So you'll see like 5%, 5%, 5.2%, 5%. And you want to kind of jump in and say that 5.2% is not right, I should take it out, but I didn't want to give myself that much discretion. If it went 5%, 5%, 15%, 5%, I was willing to say it was a typo. But so in general, there's not a lot of liquidity in those markets to begin with, but later on in our sample, so red is out of sample, there starts to be a little bit more liquidity there. Euro, we used, I think I should have mentioned it, we used the Deutschmark before the euro was introduced. Euro does pretty well, maximum's kind of 4.5. Canadian dollar does pretty well. Swiss franc does pretty well. New Zealand starts to get a little sketchy. New Zealand, we didn't have 7 and 10 year data for the full sample, so we're only looking at 5 year data. But you know, early in our sample, this is fairly noisy. New Zealand, same with Sweden, and then Norway's the one where we're kind of way off in the 5 year. All right, so 18 basis points is probably too much to stomach for most people to trade on, but it's one of our 10 currencies, so I'm willing to let it slide. I can't speak for you guys. All right, so if we want to move to a multi-currency model, the theory basically stays the same. Okay, we just have to make sure that the payoffs on all our assets are denominated in dollars. Okay, so our pricing kernel has to price domestic assets that pay off PT in domestic currency. So I'm going to think of domestic as US for now. So we better get the price of US securities right. And we better get the price of foreign securities right when we convert those foreign payoffs into US dollars. So S is going to be our exchange rate. So you think of a pound zero coupon bond that pays 1 2 years from now. We exchange that into dollars at whatever the pound dollar exchange rate is at that time. And we better get today's price in pounds converted into dollars at whatever today's exchange rate is. Okay, so it's just saying any payoff that we're trying to use our model to price, as long as we put that payoff into dollars, we better get the price back today in dollars. All right. We could think of the kind of choice of the domestic currency as relatively arbitrary. I live in the U.S. You guys live in Canada. Ulrich lives in Germany. Right? So we want to make sure that our model doesn't look different depending on who we kind of base as the domestic investor. So in any currency, there should be a pricing kernel MJ, or a risk-neutral measure, right, that corresponds where every asset returns that currency's risk-free rate. Right? So MJ better give us the price back of any assets in that foreign currency back today. Right? But our domestic pricing kernel, so I'm taking this little S here and I'm moving it over here. That was what we had in our previous slide. Better also give us back the price today in that foreign currency. So you can already see that kind of the foreign pricing kernel looks like the domestic pricing kernel times the exchange rate. The formal proof is this has to work for any payoff, so just choose the payoff that's the difference between the two, and you see that you get to a price of zero as this thing squared, so they have to be equal almost surely. Okay, math guys are smart enough to realize this. Economists have fumbled around on this forever and can't seem to get to this point. So the point is, if we want to think of it practically speaking, it means that we either have to model, if we want to go to a multi-currency model, we need to model any two of these things. Okay, so we can model the domestic risk-neutral measure if we want, and the foreign risk-neutral measure, or the domestic risk-neutral measure and the exchange rate, but we can't model three things. We can only model two of the three. All right, it's easiest to just model the pricing kernel and the exchange rate, especially if you ever want to do things like price exchange rate options. If you want to have a process that you can compute option prices off of, just start with that process. Don't kind of start by specifying what that process times the pricing kernel looks like, because you're going to end up in a mess. Okay, so our only assumption here is that assets in all of the countries can be traded, right? So if you're in the U.S., you can buy bonds in any other country. We're doing G10, so that's okay, and anybody in those foreign countries can buy bonds in the U.S. It doesn't say that bond markets have to span foreign exchange markets, okay? So that means that there can be kind of independent variation in the exchange rates that doesn't happen in the bonds themselves, which is one thing we've got kind of stuck on in finance. We thought that it only held in complete markets. In complete markets, exchange rates kind of a redundant security, but in practice, you see that there's a very low correlation between changes in the exchange rate and changes in interest rates. So it's good that we can incorporate that into a model. One of the things I see lots of times is people will ask me and say, well, if I take my pricing kernel that I estimate on US data, and I take my pricing kernel that I estimate on pound data or yen data or whatever your favorite market is, then it should be the case that this relationship holds, right? So I take a pricing kernel and I estimate it, a US pricing kernel I just estimated on US data. I take a pound pricing kernel and I just estimated on pound data. And people say, oh, there's something the matter with the market because this doesn't hold, right? The relationship only holds if the pricing kernels price the same assets. Right? If they price a different set of assets, then this thing doesn't have to hold, right? Anything can hold, and we're fine. All right, so what does this mean? Practically speaking, a multi-currency model looks exactly like a single-currency model. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. Everything's really simple still, right? The risk-free rate or the drift of our pricing kernels affine in the States, the quadratic variations affine in the States, and the risk-neutral drift is affine in the States. The only thing is that the states have to now include the exchange rates. Remember, you can model domestic and foreign pricing kernels, or just a domestic pricing kernel and the exchange rate. The easiest thing to do is just put the exchange rate into your state vector. You observe it every single day, right? You observe it minute by minute. It's not hard. It's not a latent factor or anything like that. Just add it into your vector of factors. Right? Currency or bond yields in any currency are still affine. Too late in the day to go through that math, but you can check it. Everything's nice. The one thing that's probably worth highlighting is that if you want to go from one pricing measure to another, so this is the domestic risk-neutral pricing measure. If you want to see what the drift of your vectors or your state vector looks like under a different currency's risk-neutral pricing measure, you just have to adjust it by how your state vector covaries with the exchange rate in that currency. All right, so if I have three factors here that describe the U.S. yield curve and I want to see what the drift of those factors looks like under the pound pricing measure, well, I just have to take my estimate of what the quadratic variation of those three state vectors is with the pound exchange rate. All right, that's just kind of your no arbitrage argument. All right, so if we go, if we want our model to price lots of different yields, you don't need any theory to see what you need to do. Okay, so if you just take yields in nine currencies other than the U.S. and you regress them on yields in the U.S., you're not going to get 100% R squared, right? It's just impossible. There's lots of variation in yields outside of the U.S. that isn't explained by U.S. yield factors. So I can't leave my state vector as just being the U.S. yields, right? Remember, in my single currency model, I had just three linear combinations of U.S. yields. If you want your model to price yields in other currencies, then some of your state vectors have to be linear combinations of yields in other currencies. All right. Now, I'll admit I've been kind of stuck in this decision of you have to decide whether or not you want to say there's some global factors that affect yields in all currencies, right, and local factors that affect yields in only one currency. So if you think of like a two-currency model, you could say, for the U.S. dollar and the Canadian dollar, you could say there's one factor that affects both yield curves. There's a factor that just affects the U.S. and there's a factor that just affects the Canadian yield curve. That's basically observationally equivalent to saying, but the local factors are uncorrelated. You can just say that there's two factors that affect the U.S. yield curve, there's two factors that affect the Canadian yield curve, and those factors are correlated with each other. Right? This is a way, way easier approach to start with, and they're basically equivalent. Okay? So if you ever start trying to write down these kind of multi-currency models or models that are explaining returns in lots of different currencies, it's easiest to just kind of start with your single currency model and add up. So what we're going to do is say that our state vector is just all of the state vectors from the single currency models stacked together. All right, so each currency had three factors. Essentially, there were a couple that had two. Okay, so now our state vector is, if everyone had three, it would be 30-dimensional just for yields. It's 28 because there's a couple that have two. And we still need to model those nine currencies. So we have a 37-dimensional state vector, which starts to sound crazy, right? The reality is there's kind of 37 sources of risk in these, not sources of risk, sources of variation in these yield curves. Right, so if you try to describe it, you might be able to describe it with kind of 25 factors. You're certainly not going to be able to describe it with five factors. Right, and I'm kind of arguing that it's a waste of your time to figure out how to get it down to 25 factors. Right, 37, 25, they're still big numbers. It's not going to make your life any easier. All right. The nice part about this is if you choose the factors to be the same, the pricing can look the same under the multi-currency model as it does under the single currency models. All right, so you can say that risk neutrally, each one of these curves looks like it's a single currency model, right? What you're really interested in is trying to figure out what that risk premium component of returns is. Okay, so far we've only worked with the risk neutral part of yields, right? So we're only interested in trying to understand the cross-section of yields. But if you're an investor, you don't care about the cross-section of yields. You really care about how are we expecting yields to change, right? If I buy a five-year bond today, am I expecting to make money? Am I expecting to lose money? How much am I expecting to make? How much am I expecting to lose? Okay, so the rest of the paper is going to basically focus on modeling that risk premia component or the kind of change of measure component, right? The difference between the risk neutral drift and the actual drift is telling you how much compensation you're getting for risk. Okay, so we're going to focus all our efforts basically on this part here. All right. In general, we want this thing to be affine because it gives us nice kind of closed form distributions for estimation. Okay, so we can model that as being affine in our state vector. Our state vector doesn't have to be our old x. It can be all of the yields and all of the exchange rates that we see. So this can be the vector of 7 yields in 10 currencies. So it's a 70-dimensional vector. These are 9 different exchange rates. So you have 79 possible things that your kind of risk premium could depend on in the most general setup. In theory, we shouldn't need that. In theory, our state vector should be enough because the yields themselves are just affine functions of the state vector. So if I just took a linear combination of something that's linear in the state vector, I should get something that's linear in the state vector. In practice, when you estimate these models, you're not going to be able to fit everything exactly, right? So what we're basically going to be arguing is that you don't want to ignore that cross-sectional error that you get, right? So my model says the 5-year yield is 5.5%. In reality, it's only 5%, okay? I don't want to pretend that my model's right in places where it's wrong. So you might as well condition on all of the information that you have available, essentially, when you're constructing your risk premium component. All right, so now you see that in a single currency model, we haven't spent much time thinking about the number of price risk factors. So single currency models typically have kind of 2 or 3 parameters each, and we haven't put any restrictions on risk premium. We've said that each one of those factors can be priced, which means that you can expect an excess return for investing in that factor. All right. If we kept doing that and we built up a big multi-currency model, so there's 10 currencies and each one of them have 3 factors, and we let all of these factors be priced, all of a sudden you have a model where there's 30 sources of risk that investors get compensated for. Okay? When I was in a math department, I didn't think that was anything too serious. When I moved to a finance department, 30 is crazy. All right? If you fit a model where there's 30 sources of price risk, I can virtually guarantee that you've overfit your model completely. So you want to think of how do you restrict the number of parameters that you have, right? If you let there kind of be lots of price parameters, I went through a kind of simple example. There can be 283 parameters to estimate. You're trying to estimate drift components, which are really, really hard to estimate reliably, right? If you look at kind of error bands on these estimates, they typically are massive. If you throw in kind of 200, 2800 parameters, you've got no hope at all. So we're going to take 2 approaches, and I think they're the right approaches, both kind of statistically and economically, for how to think about it. One is we're going to reduce the dimension of that R. Okay, so in theory, it could depend on this whole kind of vector of yields, right? In practice, you don't want it to depend on everything. You want to kind of reduce that from 79 to something that's a little more reasonable. I'll tell you how we're going to do that. And second is we are going to put some rank restrictions on our parameters here. So where are the parameters on these things? Okay. The rank restrictions are equivalent to saying, if I say the rank of this is 1, it says that there's 1 price risk factor in the economy. If I say the rank is 2, there's 2 price risk factors. If it's 3, there's 3 price risk factors. If it's 10, there's 10 price risk factors. Okay, so basically you want to kind of impose the economic intuition that there's not 30 price risk factors in the market, right? There's some small number of it. You don't know which ones are priced or not, so you want to let your kind of estimation tell you which linear combinations are priced, and you'll just take control over how many are priced. Okay, so how do we reduce that dimension of R? We basically take 10 single currency models and we say, what's the linear combination of yields in each of those currencies that does best at predicting those currencies' yields? Okay, so for the U.S., we get a linear combination of U.S. yields that works. We say that linear combination is R0. For the pound, we get a linear combination of pound yields that works. We say that linear combination is pounds, et cetera. And then you let the kind of global pricing kernel or the global risk premium depend on each one of those single currencies together. Okay, so we have kind of 10 individual currency components, and the global one is going to be some linear combination of those. All right, if you restrict the rank now, of lambda naught and lambda 1 to 1. You've gone from 2,800 free parameters down to 47 free parameters, so you're getting a much more parsimonious model. Two price risk factors, you get to 92 free parameters. Three, you get to 135. You've drastically reduced the number of free parameters that you have to estimate, which is a very good thing. As I'll show you. Okay, so we're going to look at, once we've done this, how well does the kind of risk premium that we've specified in the model do at predicting changes in yields, right? Remember, if you're an investor, right, and you buy bonds in Japan, you want to know what's the likelihood that the yield on those bonds is going to go up or down, or the price is going to go up or down, right? You're interested in your return. So our measure of return is going to be the change in the yield minus what we predicted the change in the yield was going to be, and we're going to kind of normalize that by what a risk-neutral investor would expect, right? So none of this is basically the kind of random walk equivalent for stocks, right? In bonds, if everything follows a random walk, then there's actually some returns, so things have to follow basically what their forward interest rate is. So under the risk-neutral hypothesis here, if my best guess at what the two-year rate is going to be 1 year from now is the forward rate from 1 to 3 today, right? That's essentially what you're doing. All right, so we're going to look at one-month predictions. In sample is, again, till the end of 2001, and then we're going to stop our estimates, right, and see how well we've done it out of sample. All right, what you're going to see, I'm going to start with the pound, and then we'll go back because the pound's kind of more typical of most currencies. Our kind of top row here is we're looking at R-squareds for predicting one-week changes in yields. Okay, and our top row is this is what we get out of the single currency model. So where the risk premium for investing in the pound is only determined by what the pound yield curve looks like today. It doesn't depend on any other yield curve. So we've just estimated a pound yield curve in isolation. And then 1, 2, and 3 are the global model. Okay, so the risk premium in the pound depends on the one global price risk factor, or the two global price risk factors, or the three global price risk factors. We stopped at 3 because the results are kind of obvious. So what you see is it's not always clear whether or not the global models do better than the single currency models in sample. All right, that's kind of a mixed bag. But in general, you see that as you add more price risk factors in your model, you tend to do better in sample. Right, that's almost by definition. Okay, if you give your model more flexibility and you want to measure how well it's doing in sample, it's going to do better and better and better. All right, so you kind of notice this pattern that the R-squareds increases, we increase the flexibility in the model. But when you go out of sample, the results reverse, right? Which is kind of evidence that even at two price risk factors or three price risk factors, you've overfit your model and you're just basically picking up noise, right? So one global price risk factor is doing best. As we move to two, the results get worse. As we move to three, the results get worse. And you see that the global model outperforms the UK model, right? So this model only has to match UK yields. This model has to match yields in 10 different currencies. But that extra discipline that we put on the model, making it fit 10 different currencies, is actually helping us to better identify a kind of robust risk premium, right? It's doing better at predicting changes in yields than the model that was designed to just predict pound yields themselves, right? The U.S. is the kind of outlier in that sample, in that the out-of-sample results for the U.S., just the single currency model, are better than the global model. But you still get the result that one global risk factor out-of-sample is better than two, which is better than three. All right, so you're going to see that across most of them. The other kind of main takeaway from this is it's really hard to predict zero. So this is Japan. Japan's yield curve has basically been flat at zero forever. That's hard to get in a model where you think that yields might actually change, God forbid. So that's hard. You're going to get poor out-of-sample statistics from all of our models there. But most of the currencies you see that that pattern, right? That the global model outperforms the single currency model. So if you're sitting in Australia and you want to predict what yields in Australia are going to look like 1 month from now, you're better off looking at the whole yield curve in all of the countries rather than just looking at Australia itself, right? And if you allow for there to be more than just one price risk factor, you're going to tend to do poorly out of sample. So same with euro, same with Canadian dollar, the short end of the Canadian dollar here is all driven by we're missing movements basically in the end of 2008. There's some big moves in the short end of the curve, I think, around that period, and our model misses those. I was almost going to leave out 3 months and 6 months because ultimately what you're interested in explaining is the returns on long-term bonds anyway. Right, you kind of know what your return from buying a three-month bond is going to be. Swiss franc, the results are the same. New Zealand, the results are the same. Sweden, same idea. Right, Norway, same idea. Okay, so it's basically only the U.S. that where the single currency model appears to do better. All of the other models, or all of the other currencies, you're better off with a global model. Remember, and it's one single global model that's working for all of the currencies. There's only one price risk factor. What that's saying is there's one portfolio of global bonds where investors get compensation for that. If you're not correlated, if you have a portfolio that's not correlated with that, you don't get any compensation. If your portfolio is kind of 50% correlated with that, you'll get 50% of that compensation, right? But all of your excess return is determined by how correlated you are with that portfolio. All right, you're also kind of interested in what's the kind of change in the exchange rate. Can you predict that or not? Exchange rates are really hard to predict. Okay, so that's the kind of outside of, it's hard to predict zero. It's also hard to predict the exchange rates. This is actually, even though you have kind of negative R squareds, it's actually outperforming most models, most kind of standard models that you'd see, because most standard models miss this giant devaluation that happened around the crisis, where every country is screwed, but most countries are screwed worse than the U.S. is. So there was a giant kind of jump there. So these are actually, even though they're negative, are actually quite reasonable compared to most models. All right, so the final part I'm going to talk about, and then I probably get donged off, right? Ah, we got a couple minutes, so we'll go through it. Is that we want to kind of look at the portfolio problem. Okay, so if you're an investor and you have the kind of freedom to invest in any bond in any of the G10 currencies, so any maturity, right, any combination of those maturities, what's the kind of optimal portfolio that you want to do, right? Financial economists are kind of interested in this because the Sharpe ratio on that optimal portfolio is kind of telling us how volatile or how big our marginal utility is, essentially, right? If the Sharpe ratio is really high, it means that the volatility of a representative investor's marginal utility is really high, right? So economists have lots of trouble with that because they think it's really hard to explain how I could be super happy one day, and super sad the next day, and then super happy again the third day. So anything with kind of high Sharpe ratios is basically seen as a puzzle in economics. All right, so we can go through. We've specified a full model, so we see how prices in our model are expected to change through time, right? So the price of any bond, zero coupon bond, is just an affine function of our state vector here. So if we want to drive what's the expected change in bond price, it's just the risk-free rate minus the weighting of that bond on the state vector multiplied by how that state vector co-varies with our pricing kernel. Basically, intuition here, pricing kernel you can think of as being marginal utility. So if something tends to pay me lots of money exactly when I really want to have lots of money, it should have a low expected return. That's your kind of insurance argument, right? You're willing to take a low expected return on your house insurance because it gives you cash exactly when you need it, right? If it tends to pay you off money exactly when you are happiest or don't really need that money, then you expect a high return, right? So you think this is basically your CAPM idea. Anyway, so we get the expected excess return on all the bonds. We get the covariance matrix on all the bonds, so we can solve for what the kind of optimal Sharpe ratio or excess return per unit of variance, right? We know that it's proportional to this and that the optimal Sharpe ratio looks like the two excess returns multiplied by the inverse of the covariance matrix. All right, so three plots and then we're done. The first one is, what is our estimate of the optimal Sharpe ratio, the maximum Sharpe ratio look like if we stop our estimates at 2002 versus if we go to our whole sample? So basically you see that they're fairly correlated with each other. They start to kind of divulge in terms of level here, right? If we use the full sample, it would say that there's not that much return for risk from 2002 onwards. But if we stopped our estimate at 2002, we would have said that the expected return should be a little bit higher. But you see that we, even though we stopped this estimate at 2002, it still said there's a lot of reward for risk to be had during the crisis here, right? Basically, people need capital. They're willing to pay you lots of money if you take the right portfolio. And so you still kind of pick up that giant jump there. We look at the question of if you're an investor and you can invest just in U.S. bonds, or you can invest in the high, kind of whole global market of bonds, or in this case, swaps. How much better can you do? So the red line is if you just can invest in bonds. The blue line is if you can expand your portfolio and also invest in Canadian bonds, Euro bonds, pound bonds, etc. So the average here, I think, is I think it's about 0.95 for just investing in the U.S., and it's about 1.7, I think, for being able to invest in global bonds. So you can basically kind of double your expected return for the same level of variance. Both those numbers are really high, right? One of the things you want to take out of this is the kind of average Sharpe ratio on the S&P 500 is like 0.5, right? And that's puzzling to economists. So if 0.5 is puzzling, I'm pretty sure that like this period here where we hung around at 3 has got to be super puzzling. And the part where we're estimating that it's 8 or 9 is really puzzling. And then finally, we look at what's the kind of Sharpe ratio that you would estimate from just investing in U.S. bonds. If you took a single currency model, so you said that risk premium that you're estimating only depends on the U.S. yield curve versus if it depends on, so red is just the U.S. yield curve. Blue is if you let your estimate depend on all of the yields. Okay, so even though you're only allowed to invest in U.S. bonds, you still look at what are the yields in all of the different currencies look like as a signal for what you think changes in yields are going to look like. And what you get out of this is that from an economic perspective, the blue line looks a lot more reasonable, right? These kind of big, giant spikes and huge variability. I don't think anybody really seriously believes that you could get an 8% expected excess return for taking 1% volatility, right? That says if you were willing to take 10% volatility in your portfolio, you get an expected return of 80%. I don't think anybody really believes that that exists. Now when you go to 13, you definitely don't believe it exists, right? For 10% volatility, you can get 130% excess return. So what we want to kind of take out of this is, even though statistically it looks like it's doing well, kind of from an economic standpoint, it looks a little crazy. Conclusion. So things that I think are worth taking away from this is that when you move to kind of multi-currency, and it doesn't just have to be multi-currency, but if you want to take your model and you want to price lots of assets with it, right, you're going to need lots of factors in your model to capture the dynamics of lots of assets, right? So let's say you wanted to model 30 stocks at the same time. You're going to need something on the order of kind of 30 factors, right? You might be able to get away with 20 factors. You're not going to be able to get away with 2 factors, right? You're going to need those factors to kind of capture dynamics, but it doesn't mean that all of those factors have to be priced. And I think the smart way to think about putting restrictions on how many of them are priced is to say you restrict that kind of the dimension of that risk premium component, right? Or you put those rank restrictions on like we did. There's pretty good evidence that say that there's only one global price risk factor, at least in these models. You can kind of read that two ways. You could say, the model's wrong, and given that it's wrong, put the most restrictions that you can on it, or you can say the model's right, and but it's only right if you allow one global price risk factor. I'd say that's reasonable. The values are really high, they're really volatile, so that's fairly puzzling. It's hard to predict exchange rates and yields. Everybody already knew that before we, or Japanese yields before we started. All right, so we're way past. Okay. Thanks for sticking around.